Morning, everybody. Let's pray, shall we? Father God, we do thank you again for this community. We thank you for the privilege of being part of this community, and we thank you for your love. We ask that you'll speak to us through your words and through each other's words, and that your will be done in everything we do here this morning. Amen. Okay. As always. Doing justice is the theory for this morning. It's part of the series that we're doing on Luke, and we'll be bopping around various little bits of Luke and going to other places as well. But the focus is this verse where Jesus says, "Woe to you Pharisees, for you tithe mint and rue and herbs of all kind, and neglect justice and the love of God. It is these you ought to have practiced without neglecting the others." Context, context, context. A lecturer of Bose once said to the group, what are the three most important things in real estate? And everybody said, location, location, location. And he said, what's the most important thing in exegesis, in studying scripture? And we all said, context, 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 which is right. The context of this is that Jesus got invited to a dinner. He was teaching, and a Pharisee heard what he was saying and invited him to a dinner. And I'm just going to blank that for a bit and read to you what happened, because it's fantastic. You get invited to a dinner, it's a compliment, you know. In this case, people had heard what Jesus with the Pharisees, it happened several times, the Pharisees heard what Jesus was saying, thought, this guy is really interesting, we want to hear more. They invited him into a Pharisee's house for dinner, and Jesus behaved extremely badly when he got there. Which is why I want to talk about it. While he was speaking, a Pharisee invited him to dine with him. He went in and took his place at the table, and the Pharisee was amazed to see that he did not wash before dinner. Interesting, one of the commentaries that I read pointed out that in actual fact, washing before a meal is not required in the Jewish law. Washing is required when you're unclean, but not before a meal. If you want to read the full details of when you should wash, it's in Leviticus 15, and it's mostly about bodily emissions, and it makes a really entertaining read. But we're not going to do that this morning. So, some other time, if you really want to. The Pharisees have made up this rule that you had to wash before a meal, and Jesus just didn't do it. And if you can, I was trying to put this into a modern context. You know, you invite someone to your house for a meal. In Western Australia, and Western Australian culture is extremely relaxed, so you might not expect that they'd turn up dressed in any particular way or anything like that. Probably you'd expect them to bring something with them, even if you'd said, don't bring a thing. You know, some chocolates, some flowers, a bottle of wine, something like that. Like, can you imagine Jesus sort of wandering in, hands in the pockets, all right, everybody, you know? And then just sitting down. He didn't wash his hands. He didn't do any of the things that would be expected about him. And he knew that the Pharisee was surprised he hadn't washed his hand. We don't know whether he actually said anything or not, but he knew that. So he immediately gets stuck into them. He, you know, there's all these people there. There's the guests. And he starts telling them off. Imagine that. Have you had that happen in your house when you've invited someone over for dinner? They wander in, they haven't brought a present, they're just shabbily dressed, they sit down, and then they start telling you what's wrong with the way you live your life. You have had that experience.
Especially if
they're
family and
they're Dutch. Okay, family maybe. Yeah, family probably. So, got this. He says, you Pharisees, you clean the outside of the cup and the dish, but inside you're full of greed and wickedness. So he's talking about washing there. He's saying all you're doing is cleaning the outside of the body, whereas there's filth inside. You guys are filthy inside. You fools. That's nice, isn't it? Did not the one who made the outside make the inside also? You fools, he shouted at the people who were there. Woe to you, Pharisees. We might say, shame on you, Pharisees. For you tithe, this is the thing we're looking at today, you tithe the mint and the rue and herbs of all kinds, but you neglect justice and the love of God. It is these you ought to have practiced without neglecting the others. Woe to you, Pharisees! You love to have the seats of honour in the synagogues, to be greeted with respect in the marketplace. Woe to you! One of the lawyers who was there, these are people who teach the law, said to Jesus, "Teacher, when you say these things, you insult us too." Jesus said, "Woe also to you lawyers. You load people with burdens hard to bear, and you yourselves do not lift a finger to ease them." I'm not reading the whole passage, by the way. I'm going right towards the end of it now. "Woe to you lawyers, you have taken away the key of knowledge. You did not enter yourselves, and you hindered those who were entering." If you're following it, I've gone leapt through to verse 52, I think. I can't quite see it. "Woe to you lawyers, you've taken away the..." Listen to this. Imagine this. These people are teachers, right? Now, there's quite a few people here who are teachers and have taught in various ways. He says, "Woe to you lawyers, you have taken away the key of knowledge. You have, you did not enter yourselves, and you hindered those who were entering." I'm right at the end of my Master's in Divinity, and I'm writing this big project. And I have to work closely with a supervisor, and my supervisor, Dr. Evelyn Ashley, is an expert in New Testament and an expert in New Testament Greek. She really is very highly regarded nationally and internationally. And we were talking the other day, I'm a teacher, she's a teacher, about what makes a good teacher. And a good teacher, we decided, is somebody who is absolutely focused on what's good for the student. And I think we've all had bad teachers who are actually focused on letting people know how important and how clever they are. A really good student is actually a humble, or a really good teacher is actually a really humble servant of the people who they are teaching. They want to encourage them, they want to build them up, they want them to learn, they want them to grow. In my enormous collection of quotes, there's one that I particularly love, "The purpose of education is to replace an empty mind with an open one." And this is what teachers are doing. They're helping people to think. They're totally focused on their student. And Jesus was criticizing these teachers. "You've taken away the key of knowledge. You didn't get into it yourself. You hindered those who were trying to enter it." So they're not helping their students at all. Jesus was always going on about this, that the teachers were not doing their job. If we go back to that verse where it would get returning to doing justice, it says, "You neglect justice and the love of God." That would really... Sorry?
What verse is that?
Luke 11:42. That would have really hit them hard, neglect justice and the love of God. If you recall when Jesus was talking about the main two commandments, you will love God, you will love your neighbour. That situation, as it's recorded in Luke, it was actually one of the teachers of the law who first said to him, "What's the most important commandment?" And Jesus threw it back on him. He didn't answer it. In the version that Luke tells us, he said to him, "You know the law, what do you say?" And the man immediately said, "Love God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your voice." So the teachers of the law knew that the love of God was important. And because they studied the Old Testament, they also knew the importance of justice. The importance of doing justice goes right back to the beginning of the Bible. Genesis, this is God talking about Abraham. Why did God choose Abraham? "I've chosen him that he may charge his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice." And you then get right through the Old Testament, this theme going on. This is my synopsis of the Old Testament. If you want to know what the Old Testament says, this is what it says, okay? I've cut out the boring bits. And trust me, the important thing about these commands is that they are repeated through the Old Testament. They don't just come up once, they come up again and again and again. They come up before the law of Moses, they come up in the law of Moses, they come up in the prophets. And they just keep coming up. So love God and serve only him, give to the poor, befriend the alienated, stand up for the oppressed, seek justice for those who are not getting justice. I would suggest that actually those last four are all about justice in the terms that we understand justice. They're all talking about justice. And we can't leave the Old Testament without looking at Micah 6:8. He has shown you, O mortal, what is good. What does the Lord require of you? To act justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God. Act justly. We're doing justice again. Have I hammered this home enough? Yes. What did Jesus say? Going through to the New Testament, to what did Jesus say? Didn't Jesus, when Jesus talks about doing justice, he doesn't actually talk about justice, but he does talk a lot about doing. This is really important for Jesus. Again in Luke 6:46, why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do what I tell you? I will show you what someone is like who comes to me, hears my words, and acts on them. This is the introduction to the parable of the wise and foolish builders, which I'm sure you all know. But the whole point of the story of the wise and the foolish builders, the difference between the two of them, they both heard the words of Jesus, and the wise one acted on the words of Jesus. That's what the story is saying, and that's what the message of the story is that if you want to be like the wise builder, you don't just hear the words of Jesus, you act on them. So the wise builder, as we know, dug down deep foundations, got down to the bedrock, built the house on that, and when the storm came, the house stood still and stood firm, and the foolish builder just built it on the sand, and when the storm came, it got knocked down. Jesus doesn't tell us what the building is. Leaves us to think about that for ourselves. But he built a strong structure. You can say that's our faith, that's our life in God, that's a good life that we build, whatever you want to put it. You get that way by listening to the words of Jesus and acting on them. But the important thing is that the difference between those two builders is that they both heard Jesus' words. The guy who built the strong house acted on them. And of course, we can't leave the teachings of Jesus without this passage, which is we are so fond of in this church, the sheep and the goats bit. It's the same story. Then the king will say to those at his right hand, and we've been singing it this morning, as you probably know. Then the king will say to those at his right hand, come you that are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. I was naked and you gave me clothing. I was sick and you took care of me. I was in prison and you visited me. What a list of things to do. But these are the people that God is going to welcome into his kingdom. Oh, it's not perhaps the people who... hang on. Okay, no. If you just go back to that illustration of the of who built the good house, the person who acts on the word of Jesus. Just contrast that a bit with some of the things that you might think. You know, the person who is commended by God in this sense is not the person who's got a lot of head knowledge. It's not the person who goes to bows and studies and gets degrees. You know, it's not the person who spends a lot of time in Bible study or even perhaps in prayer, although Jesus certainly told his followers to pray. It's doing stuff. It's looking after your neighbour. There's some very unhappy faces around. We'll find out why in a minute, hopefully. Just want to talk about this man. You remember back in round about Easter time, just before Easter, we played the last 15 minutes of Martin Luther King's last speech, which included a sermon. In that speech, that was good stuff. In that speech, he came up with this phrase, let us develop a kind of dangerous unselfishness. I think this is such a brilliant phrase, because if you're going to do justice, there's going to be a cost. And he actually preached a mini sermon, you may remember, on the Good Samaritan. And he quite generously, talking about the scribe and the priest who walked past and didn't help him, he actually quite generously said there might have been very good reasons why they didn't stop to help him. But he said, but the Samaritan wasn't concerned, didn't think, what will happen to me if I stop and help this man? He thought, what's going to happen to this man if I don't stop and help him? It's a very important principle in Martin Luther King's thinking. And he was talking to a church full of people, and he was trying to encourage them the next day to get out and march in support of the sanitation workers in Memphis The sanitation workers, you know, the lowest form of life, the ones who clean the sewers and collect all the rubbish and that kind of thing. The black ones, the black sanitation workers, had very poor conditions of service compared with the white sanitation workers. And that's why Martin Luther King was in Memphis. He was saying to the people there, you know, it's going to cost you. You know, you give up a day's work to go on this march, or you leave school for the day to go on this march. Or if you're a pastor, you stop doing all the work that you have to do in order to go on this march. But don't think about what it's going to cost you, because the question is not what is going to happen to you if you support the sanitation workers. The question is what's going to happen to the sanitation workers if you do not support them. And this is the core of justice for Martin Luther King. And that phrase, I think, is just... it's not the idea that if you're going to seek justice is going to be dangerous. It's dangerous on two levels. The reason it's going to be dangerous for me, for us, to do things which promote justice is that if there is injustice, somebody is benefiting. And the person who is benefiting from the fact that there is injustice doesn't want things to change. Therefore, it's dangerous for you to stand up for people who need justice because you are standing up against some kind of an establishment oppression. We may have time to talk about that. We may not. Finally, I will sprint through this. Last week's service, when Simon Holthouse came to speak, if you weren't there, I have heard thousands of sermons in my life. Very few of them affected me emotionally the way that did. And he was talking about this stuff. When the fires happened at Yarloop, I knew they'd happened. I thought, this is terrible. I prayed. I didn't jump in my car and go and help. Lots of people did jump in their cars and go and help. It really got to me that. But you remember during the conversation, I think it was Paul started it, we started talking about communication. Oh no, Simon Holthouse had said how poor the communication was between the government agencies. And we got into this conversation about communication. And I'm still trying to think my way through this stuff, but I think communication is incredibly important in this context. That we don't just occasionally get out on marches or do that sort of thing, but we are constantly talking about justice. I think one of the things you can do when you do justice is simply name justice. Just saying this is unjust or saying this is just. You know, just by saying that and saying it loudly and saying it to lots of people, you are actually doing justice. And we are in a world where we have phenomenal capacity to do that kind of thing. So one thing which I think we certainly can do, whether you approve of Facebook or not, almost all of us would have some access to the internet. And that is somewhere where if you see something, I think, which is really good, which is about justice, then share it. That's actually quite an easy thing to do. It just involves hitting one, maybe two buttons. It can be done in a couple of seconds. Just share the good stuff. And there's lots of good stuff out there. The difficult bit is standing up against the bad stuff, where you see something where somebody is saying something which is clearly unjust, of actually coming online, making a comment and saying, this is unjust and this is why. Okay, we have 5 minutes. Someone else say something. Can we get that microphone? That's good.
Pete, the thing I also wonder about is that when we choose not to act for justice on somebody else's behalf, as well as it impacting on them, the person that it really impacts on is ourselves.
Yes.
And I think there's probably no one so miserable as someone who has gone through their entire life ignoring injustice. Yeah.
Yeah, good.
We had a great deal of difficulty in defining justice because it's partly a relative concept and it's partly... It's actually based on an assumption. It's based on we assume that we have a common shared understanding of what justice is. And for those of us who come from a Christian background, it's almost certain that there's a transcendent set of a transcendent moral code that sits above us, and we can safely assume that we have that shared understanding, and that informs our distinction between justice and law. Justice is that higher moral code that we all assume, that we all think the same about, and law is our human implementation of codifying that to the best that we can. But it just occurs to me how important communication is, because we don't always have a shared understanding of what justice is. Some people have a very narrow understanding of justice, and the only way you get to find that out is by communicating, as I discovered with my family, who have a very evangelical, narrow understanding of what justice is and are very pro, for example, repealing that part of the Racial Discrimination Act, so that, because it's unjust that we shouldn't be able to say what we want. And yet, from my sense of justice, I feel very strongly no, that keeps a lid on the worst excesses of how we live together. So we just got to be really careful what we mean.
Because it is so amorphous. So I try to say, what does justice mean or look like for me every day? And I put it in the workplace, but it's true of marriage. For me, to act justly in a conflictual situation, and also I got an insight in between the relationship between justice and mercy, because we talked about that, is... For me, if I'm in a conflictual situation, to act justly is to be committed to pay attention to my interests and the other person's interest. To be committed to say, I need to care for what they need or their situation and my own. It's not just pushing my barrow. I'm not saying this holds up the answer. And then I recognise that if I'm paying attention to the other person's interests as well as my own, and I'm trying to find that out, then I'm more likely, and I think they're more likely, I'm more likely to act with mercy or generosity rather than fight over it. So I found that really helpful. Locates it. And I think that is partly applicable, that's partly how we ended up with that notion of justice is... treating other people like we want to be treated. But thinking to what you're saying, Paul, until we talk about that, we don't find the common ground. So for me, it made it concrete in a way that so much of the conversation about justice is way out there in its head stuff, and it's overwhelming.
It bothers me a bit that justice is often more about getting what you want. And I hear people talk about getting justice when that's all they mean. It seems to me that really it has to be the other way around, where getting justice is about getting justice for the people you see who are oppressed. And I'm conscious that in our society we have a very strong hierarchy of justice, where we've got some people who are in a very powerful social situation where they're on top of the pile, if you like, and they generally get their own way. We've got people at the bottom of the pile who very rarely get what they want or need, but it's the people at the top of the pile who should be advocating for justice for the lower ones. The lower ones might be calling for it, but they haven't got the power to get it. But the difficult part is the ones at the top who've got it actually enjoy their privileged position, and it's not in their interests to give justice to the ones underneath. Mm.
So you need people to stand up. And yes, yeah. Luke?
really loud. Okay. The quote that I read this morning went along the lines of, if you're privileged, then equality can look a lot like oppression.
Are we done?
Yep.
Bevan?
Just a short, small observation. When I was in the Department of Civil Aviation, they changed all the rules, and we, as a collective group of surveyors, inspectors, went along, there's about 20 of us, and we said, there is no justice, you know, the way you're producing these rules. And the lawyers said to us, you've got to realise there is no justice. And that was their observation, the lawyer's observation. And I hear what Michael said a moment ago, and we're frequently getting emailed content of injustices being perpetrated, and we've got to go and send this on to keep this injustice circulating. And I'm constantly blotting my copybook with my friends and colleagues that, or people that want to go and pursue a particular agenda, I mean, agenda that is against justice.